Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure: startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
License and registration. The driver flinched, blinked a few times, and scrambled for the glove box. He panicked, missed the latch. When he finally opened it, papers spilled out, and he sat there frozen before scooping them up. I've been a police officer for 2 decades. Night shifts out in the country usually meant nothing more than drunk drivers, runaways from one of the nearby shelters, or coyote calls from ranches with loose fencing. It was rare for anything to linger in my mind after a shift ended. Most of it was the same monotony, repeated again and again. But that night was different. That one etched itself in slow, vivid pieces I still haven't managed to fully pull apart. The moon had been high and full, casting a silver wash over everything. I was parked off Country Road 8, half asleep, when a car zoomed past me, going at least 2 times the speed limit. I sighed and figured it was just another guy out too late, probably drinking. I flipped my lights on and found them pulled over near the bend without much resistance. I walked up to the driver's side. The car was an old Toyota, probably early 2000s, primer patches on the fender, muffler rattling. Both men inside looked wrecked. The driver was gripping the wheel hard enough that I could see the tension pushing veins through the skin. His hair was flattened with sweat. The guy in the passenger seat stared forward, not blinking, hands in his lap. That's where it all began. The driver handed me his license with both hands finally. His voice cracked when he spoke. "Can you give us a fine? Anything, please. We just need to go." I ignored their nagging and instead asked what I always ask. "Have you two been drinking?" They both answered, but not together. They looked at each other first, silently, like they were trying to argue how much to admit. Then the driver said no. Passenger echoed it, his voice low and scratchy. I looked them both over again. "All right, I'm going to run your information. Turn the vehicle off for me." The driver hesitated, but ultimately killed the ignition. I returned to my cruiser and ran the plate and driver's name. Nothing suspicious. Nothing at all, actually. The owner of the vehicle matched the driver. Everything came back clean. When I returned to their window, they had gotten significantly worse. The driver's head was twitching toward his shoulder every few seconds like a muscle spasm. The passenger was in a similar condition. When the driver spoke again, his voice had a strain that sounded close to breaking. "You don't understand. We have to go. We're out of time, sir. Can we just go now?" That's when I started getting angry. Everyone always had somewhere to go. It gets old. I told him to keep his hands on the wheel and to relax. "This doesn't have to be a big thing. You listen, I listen. You're making this worse by acting jumpy. I'm going to need you to perform a field sobriety test for me." The driver's eyes darted to the mirror and then to the trees ahead. His leg was bouncing now, heel thumping against the floorboard. "We don't have time, please." I took a deep breath, stepped back, and started to circle toward the back of the vehicle to get them out. That was when the engine roared to life again. Tires screamed against the dirt shoulder as they shot forward, fishtailing back onto the road and vanishing around the bend. I stood there for a second, blinking. My first thought was, what the hell are you running from? I sprinted to the cruiser, threw the door open, and called it in. This is Unit 18. We got a 1080, fleeing vehicle, silver Toyota, heading eastbound on Country Road 8. Two occupants, I'm in pursuit. The tires spat gravel as I pulled out onto the road behind them. The moon followed us both, glaring and wide. The car struggled to hold a line. It swerved out of its lane every time the tires gripped, overcorrected, and skidded. The taillights bounced in and out of view ahead of me. Ahead of us was a wooden sign. Camp Winding Pines, Youth Retreat. The trees thinned ahead, and the gravel turned to soft earth. My headlights caught the rear of the car as it fishtailed sideways, back tires chewing up dust and pine needles. The engine revved again, but lost traction entirely. I saw the nose of the Toyota swing off the road, and the whole car vanished through the tree line. A split second later, there was the sound of branches snapping and a hollow, metallic thud. I hit the brakes and threw the cruiser into park. My boot hit the dirt before I'd finished radioing the update. Vehicles crashed, east perimeter of Winding Pines, approaching scene now. My blood was hot. My thoughts weren't entirely rational, because all I could focus on was the fact that they'd gone from a routine stop to endangering everyone at that camp and themselves too. I pulled the flashlight and unsnapped my pistol holster, just in case. People typically get dangerous when cornered, and this is about as cornered as you can be. They had to have a reason for speeding away like that. The car had come to a stop against a thick pine, the front end crushed in but not folded. Steam hissed from the hood. A branch had punctured through the back window and scattered glass across the back seat. "Put your hands where I can see them," I shouted. No movement. I approached the driver's side, light cutting through the cabin. The driver's airbag had gone off. He was slumped against it, head back, mouth open. A thin line of blood ran from his eyebrow to his cheek. He was breathing. I swung the beam to the passenger side. The guy in the passenger seat hadn't survived. His arms were bent under him, and his legs were angled against the passenger side seat in a way I didn't think was even possible. The neck hung off his collarbone, head tipped unnaturally with the jaw slack and lopsided. It was a grotesque scene. That's when the driver gasped awake. He fought with the seatbelt for a second, then shoved the door open, landing on all fours in the dirt. I stepped up fast and pointed the flashlight at him. "What the hell do you think you were doing? You ran from a stop and killed your friend. Over what?" He didn't answer. He didn't even look at me. He rolled onto his back, eyes skyward, then suddenly turned over again and started scrambling to his feet. I grabbed for his wrist, but he tore away, stumbling once before crashing into the tree line. "God damn it," I snarled and ran after him. Low branches clawed at my shirt, pine needles filled my boots. The sound of him moving ahead wasn't fast or steady. He was desperate and clumsy. I caught up to him near a slope where the tree cover thickened. He was crouched with one hand pressed to the dirt and the other to his chest, trying to breathe. Sweat poured off him in waves, soaking through the collar of his shirt and streaking down his arms. His pupils were huge, swallowing almost all the color. I grabbed him by the elbow and pinned him against the pine trunk. "Hey, are you on something? You high?" I held my grip and looked him over again. His pulse was racing under my thumb. "You need Narcan? Tell me now." He didn't answer right away, and people that need Narcan usually never do. His mouth opened and closed a few times before anything came out. What did make it out didn't make sense. "Listen, If you hide now, maybe I won't know you are nearby. I'd seen overdoses before, plenty of them. Some twitch and mutter, others go still and drop. This looked like the textbook interpretation of a situation when Narcan was to be administered ASAP. I told him to stay with me and started guiding him back the way we came. He walked with me, barely. It almost seemed like he was trying to fight my grip, but he was too weak. He dragged his feet, and his breath scraped through his throat, eyes darting wildly. We made it to the tree line, and I got him to the cruiser. The back seat was clean. I helped him in, closed the door, and stepped back. I reached for the radio on my shoulder. "Dispatch, this is Unit 18. I've got one fatality at the crash site and one possible overdose. Suspect is incoherent, requesting EMS priority." I went around to the front of the cruiser and opened the glove box, pulled the Narcan kit free, checked the spray, and turned back. The shouting coming from the back of the vehicle stopped me. It was a low, thick clicking sound, almost like retching, but wetter. I stepped around and aimed the flashlight at the rear window. He was shaking. His whole body was moving with these wild spasms, his limbs flailing against the seat and his jaw snapping open and shut. He started to break apart. It began at the arms, skin pulling apart in long, wet lines, muscles swelled underneath it, raw and coiled, growing outward. Thick strands of fur pushed through the seams. His shirt tore open at the chest, then peeled away as his shoulders expanded, bones cracked and reset themselves. I heard them go one at a time, snapping like twigs underfoot. His mouth opened in a silent scream, and a second row of fangs pushed out of his gums while the original teeth dropped into his lap. His face stretched forward as the skull reshaped, eye sockets shifting as they sat further apart. A snout forced its way forward, the cartilage crunching as it grew. The cruiser exploded outward as it launched itself through the window. The back half of the car ripped open, metal screamed and plastic shattered. I staggered back and drew my sidearm, took aim and fired. One, two, three. The shots hit. They had to have. I saw dark bursts bloom through the fur. But it didn't drop. It didn't even flinch. Then it stopped moving. Its nose twitched, turning toward the direction of the camp. There was a noise off in the distance, somewhere far beyond the trees. It sounded like a bell or something similar. It heard it, and it started running toward the youth camp. Its whole body dropped low, and it moved on all fours, fast and lopping. Each stride pushed it deeper into the woods, until I couldn't see it anymore. I stood in front of the scene I just witnessed with my gun still up, frozen in time. I raised the radio to my mouth with a hand that wouldn't stay still. My finger hesitated on the transmit button, because I didn't know what to say. My head was still ringing, but that wasn't why my voice came out unsteady. "This is Unit 18. I paused and tried again. "Someone is heading toward Camp Winding Pines. Big, heavily armed, I think. My vehicle is destroyed, and he ran off toward the camp. I need backup now. Emergency priority." The reply didn't take long. "Copy that, Unit 18. The nearest support is 60 minutes out. Chopper support is unavailable. Do you need medical?" I stared at the ruined back of my cruiser. I didn't waste time trying to rationalize what I'd seen. If I stood there thinking about it, I wasn't going to move. I keyed the mic again. "Negative on med. I'm going in." I let the radio fall back to my shoulder, then turned toward the trunk. It took some force to pry it open. The frame had twisted when the back exploded out. I grabbed the shotgun from inside, racked it to make sure it was live, and checked the sling for rounds I kept clipped in a side pouch. I jogged up the trail, following the dirt where its weight had torn into the soil. They were wide at the front and dragged behind, deep enough to catch a boot heel and trip someone if they weren't careful. Up ahead, tucked behind a split rail fence with a cheap floodlight flickering against the roof, I went up and knocked hard against the window. A man inside jolted awake and nearly spilled the styrofoam cup from the desk. I raised my badge before he had any chance to say anything. "Police, Officer Dunley, something's loose in the camp. I need you with me. Are you armed?" He blinked at me, still halfway out of sleep, then nodded. Yeah, what's going on?" "There's something in the camp. I don't know what, but the kids aren't safe." He stared at me a second longer, and I could see the disbelief behind his eyes. But a moment later, he opened the drawer and pulled out a pistol, tucked it into a hip holster, and locked the door behind him. We started toward the center of the camp. He finally spoke behind me. "Are you going to tell me what we're looking for?" I didn't stop walking. "You wouldn't believe me. I just saw a police officer walk out the woods looking manic. You might be surprised what I'll believe tonight." I didn't answer. He picked up his pace to match mine. "The kids, they're all inside right now?" I asked. "Yeah, we just got here today. I drove the kids here. Most are probably asleep. Staff does lights out around 10. It's a full week retreat. They get the run of the place during the day. Bonfires, archery, swimming, all that. At night, they're supposed to stay in cabins." "What's out here?" I didn't have answers. Every question he asked was something I'd already tried to ask myself and come up short. After a while, I raised the hand and told him to stop asking so many questions I didn't know. We cleared the brush line and the tree cover opened. Ahead of us was the center trail, wide enough to fit a vehicle. On the left, two cabins faced each other across a patch of lawn, and at the end of the trail, angled slightly toward the turn loop, was a bus. As we approached the cabins, I slowed and lowered the barrel of the shotgun. The guard caught up beside me, still scanning the dark. "Tell me how this place is laid out," I said. He glanced around and started pointing. "There are 6 cabins in total, all lined up in 2 rows, 3 on each side. Staff buildings over there past the main trail, near the mess hall. We've got a generator shed behind that, and the first aid hut closer to the lake. No perimeter fencing, but we've never needed it." "And inside?" I asked. "Each cabin's got 2 rooms, one for the kids and one for the staff assigned to them. Usually a counselor or a teacher sleeps in the same space or the next room." "How many in each?" "This group is light. Maybe 6 or 7 per right now." We stopped outside the nearest door. The building was quiet. A single bulb over the entryway flickered but stayed on. I looked through the window. Nothing but the outline of bunks in the dark. "Here's what we're doing," I said. "We go in quiet, wake the adult first. You help them get the kids up. No screaming, no explaining. Tell them to head for the bus. Stay low, stay quiet. Once they're there, they crouch behind it and wait." He swallowed hard, then nodded. I pushed the door open. It led out a creak, but not enough to wake anyone. The air inside was stale, heavy with the warmth of sleeping bodies. I moved toward the back, where I could make out a single adult figure in the bed along the far wall. I leaned in close and shook their shoulder once. They stirred and squinted at me. "Police, stay quiet," I whispered, flashing my badge. Wake the kids, get them dressed enough to move. Tell them it's a drill if you need to. Lead them to the bus and crouch behind it. The teacher nodded and sat up fast, already calling out in a low voice to the bunk nearest to her. The kids began to stir. The next few minutes passed without a sound louder than soft shuffling and half whispers. The children dressed in silence. The teacher guided them out one by one, leading the group with a hand pressed to the wall. I stood at the threshold and watched until the last pair ducked into the dark, headed toward the bus. The guard moved beside me, his hand on his weapon, breathing unevenly. "One down," I said. We didn't linger. We moved onto the second location. We eased in, flashlight low, barely tracing the floor. Bunk beds lined both walls. The kids in them were out cold, limbs tangled in thin sheets. Some had toys on their pillows, shoes beside the frame, and old paperback books slipped beneath mattresses. I stepped between two of the beds, careful not to let my boots squeak on the waxed floor. No movement, no sounds except snoring and the soft click of the cabin window panes shifting against the breeze. This cabin was bigger. We woke the teacher up, gave them the same commands, and got underway to the next room. In the third room, it was the same drill. On the fourth one, however, the door's base had visible claw marks on it. I motioned to the guard, and we took our positions on either side. I opened it slowly. I could feel it before we even stepped inside. A drop in the air pressure. My flashlight scanned the bunks. Kids were asleep, and I kept scanning the room, looking for anything. The security behind me let out an audible gulp and touched my shoulder. I turned to look at him, but he didn't speak. He pointed up. Above us, pressed against the beams between the rafters, he was watching. Its claws were buried in the wood, six of them spread outward to anchor its weight. The arms were stretched long and sinewy, joints bowed out in unnatural angles. Its stomach rose and fell with short breaths. Mucus hung from its mouth in strands. Its chest was still wet from the transformation. Patches of fur matted to bare, swollen muscle. It stared at the smallest bed in the room. The girl in it had her face turned up, breathing through her mouth, one arm hanging over the edge of the mattress. I raised the shotgun and fired. The blast lit the room in one flash. The slug tore through its shoulder, ripping a chunk of its back out. It roared. No, it screamed. Something deeper than anything I'd ever heard to this day. Kids woke up instantly, and chaos erupted. I pumped the shotgun and fired again. This time the thing moved. It came down fast. Not a fall, but a lunge that ripped it free of the ceiling and sent pieces of beam flying with it. I tried to shoot once more as it hit the floor, but before I could even so much as take another step, it slammed its arm into my weapon and shattered it clean in half. The guard shouted behind me. The monster rammed into him and knocked him against the back wall. Then it disappeared through the open door in a blur of limbs. I stood there, holding the ruined half of my shotgun, my arms shaking, lungs heaving. "Get the kids to the bus," I shouted, turning toward the guard. "Now, move!" He stumbled up, paled and wide-eyed, but he nodded. We yanked open the rest of the doors and started dragging everyone awake. Anyone who asked what was going on got told to move on. Some listened, some hesitated. I shoved them forward. Screaming started in the distance. Not children, adults. Someone farther in the camp, in a separate spot. I turned toward it, but didn't move. I couldn't go. If I left now, even to try and stop it, the kids would be put in danger. "Keep them moving," I told the guard. Get them to the damn bus. I'll follow. Go. I stayed behind them, waiting for it to show again. The only thing I had now was my 9mm. Nothing worth using, but I had to try. The bus came to life, cutting through the noise of crying children and panicked adults. The last few teachers climbed on, pushing kids down the aisle. I looked out toward the woods once more. The trees were quiet, and somehow, that was worse. I boarded last, and the door slammed shut behind me. The guard sat in the driver's seat, white-knuckled on the wheel, eyes flicking between the road and the mirrors. I walked the aisle, gun drawn, scanning every window. The bus groaned as it moved forward. I felt each shift in the tires, every bump of dirt and gravel. We got back on the road and kept moving at a steady pace. I was near the back of the bus, facing the left side. And suddenly, through the trees, there was movement. It was running, keeping up with the bus. Its gait was off. One arm hung limp at its side, still dragging. The arm I'd hit with a shotgun. The other clawed forward with each leap, digging through brush, flinging it behind. Its face was set forward, mouth open, eyes locked onto the vehicle. I shouted toward the front. Faster, go, don't slow down. The trees gave way to the slope that led down toward the bridge. I could feel the edge of it coming. It jumped. The impact shook the entire frame. The roof bowed inward and metal popped near the rear. Kids screamed in every direction. The bus tilted for a moment before rocking back into balance. Something's on the roof. Is something on the roof? The guard shouted. He slammed the brakes for a second, but the whole chassis veered, wheels catching the edge of the bridge. We can't swerve, I barked. Keep it straight, or we're never going over. The bus started to shake again. The weight shifted from front to back as the creature moved. You could hear the metal strain with every step it took across the roof. In a split second, a massive claw tore through the ceiling above the driver's seat, ripping down clean through the thin steel. The guard didn't even have time to scream. The strike came fast, and his head separated from his shoulders in a clean, diagonal motion. His body twitched once, then slumped sideways, arm locked against the wheel. The bus tilted hard to the right. Then it flipped. Metal tore against pavement. Screams drowned everything. The lights inside cut out, and my body slammed into the back seat in front of me. I remember the sound of windows shattering, the screech of steel folding, and the wet thump of bodies hitting the walls. We slid to a stop. Smoke seeped in from somewhere behind me. I was on my side, face mashed against the wall, and my vision blurred. I heard screaming, but not from inside. Through the cracked windshield and side panels, I could see it. Its arms had wrapped through part of the roof's metal lattice, caught in the bend. Its legs thrashed against the air, claws tearing through the breeze, searching for traction. It was still attached to the bus with its arm. Its other useless arm was dangling in the air outside. Its weight was pulling the whole vehicle forward. The bus had stopped on the slope near the drop. The concrete barrier outside was cracked and sunken. If it tipped, we'd go over. The monster screamed again, voice raw and furious, spit raining down through the cracks. Every time it flailed, the nose of the bus dipped a little further down toward the edge. I pushed myself up, head swimming. If it kept pulling, the bus was going into the river, and we'd go with it. I grabbed my pistol from beside me and moved toward the front. Every inch I crawled made the bus shift. The people around me were mostly unconscious, but were slowly stirring awake, causing the bus to list even more. I pressed my shoulder to the wall and used the seats to guide myself forward. The smoke inside the cabin had thickened. I raised the pistol up at an angle from the side of one of the cracked windows, aimed center mass, and pulled the trigger until the slide locked back. Countless rounds punched through. It screamed, head snapping back once, but didn't fall. It was completely stuck. I dropped the gun. It was useless now. I looked around for anything I could do or use. The shattered plastic and hanging wire offered nothing. I looked at the front panel by the windshield. There was a fire axe mounted. The bus was old, so old that it still had a fire axe. The glass over the case had already been cracked from the impact. I slammed my elbow into it and broke through. My fingers wrapped around the handle and I yanked it free. The blade looked older than me, but it was solid. I didn't have time to second guess it. I crawled the last few feet, pushing through snap seat supports and shattered glass. The closer I got, the more it thrashed. Its body was angled down now, and it had made progress in its thrashing, but I needed to send it down for good. I brought the axe down. The first strike sank into the muscle above its wrist. It screamed and flailed maniacally, enough to tear across my forearm. Warm blood poured from the cut. I didn't stop. I raised the axe again and brought it down where the elbow had bent backward into the metal. The joint cracked. It loosened. I hit again and again. The tendon finally snapped. The rest of the body fell free, but the mangled arm stayed stuck. The monster dropped away screaming, claws raking empty air, then vanished into the dark gorge below. The scream echoed for a few seconds, then cut off. The bus groaned again and shifted. We needed to get out of there fast. For a moment, no one moved. A teacher near the middle broke the silence and began yelling for everyone to stay calm and get out as soon as possible. I limped back along the floor, holding the cut across my arm with my palm to stop the bleeding. I helped the nearest ones get out first, guided them through the back panel as it opened. Other adults took over from there, ushering the kids onto the road and away from the bus. Smoke still clung to everything, my vision blurred from the blood loss and the ringing in my ears. I could barely feel my legs. Once everyone was off, I lowered myself down from the rear of the bus. I remember stepping onto the pavement, still carrying the axe, and standing there without saying anything while the kids huddled together behind me. Everyone was covered in ash and blood and smoke. But we were alive. The bus let out a low groan. Something inside popped. The weight had shifted again. Its front tilted toward the edge, the left side pulling down first. I yelled for everyone to back up. The whole thing tipped off the edge and slid forward. Tires scraped once against the concrete. And it dropped. Red lights flickered between the trees as the first cruiser appeared from the main road. Then two more. Ambulance headlights swept the edge of the woods. They finally came. A blur of boots and flashlights closed in, radios buzzing. Paramedics pulled out stretchers, officers fanned out. I watched all of it as if I were stuck in a tunnel. One of them called out my name. "Jesus, Dunley, what the hell happened?" It was Jameson, someone I knew. He took one look at me, then grabbed my shoulder and started leading me back toward the perimeter. "Come on, sit down. You're bleeding. You're out on your feet." I didn't argue. I followed him to the back of a cruiser where a paramedic opened a kit and started cleaning the cuts across my arm. Everything stung, but it didn't matter. The paramedic asked something, but I didn't answer. Then another medic approached with a clipboard. "We need to know where the first body is, the one you radioed in at the original crash. You said one fatality." I nodded. "Where?" Jameson touched my arm. "You said there was a wrecked car." "Yeah," I said. My throat was dry. "In the forest, back on the shoulder near the main trail. It's not too far out." They helped me into the cruiser and drove me down. We passed the broken fence and came up to where the Toyota had hit the tree. Two medics got out and moved toward the rear of the vehicle. I stayed behind, leaning on the open door. Then one of them turned back and called to me. "There's no one back here." I stood up straighter. "What?" He motioned again. "There's blood, but there's no body." We walked toward them, looked through the window myself. The back seat was soaked. You could still see the pattern where the blood had dried, pulled down to the floor mat. The seatbelt was stained red and stiff. But the body wasn't there. Not a single bone, not a piece of fabric, not a trace. I stepped back, blinking. Jameson stood next to me. "Was he dead when you saw him?" "Yeah," I said. "Could he have moved?" "No." I looked past the car, into the trees behind the clearing. A question rang in my head at that moment. Was it not the only one?